Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Hallie Sutton. This will be the only time in her life. She's a debut novelist, and her brand new novel is The Lady Upstairs. It's set in Los Angeles, California. It is a fantastically written work of fiction here. And Hallie, jumping right into this, you have got a book here where you have ladies who are involved in a very interesting business in Los Angeles. Can you describe what it is? Because I've never thought of this as a business, let alone a subject for a novel.
Yes, thank you. The Lady Upstairs is a feminist noir about women in Los Angeles who run a blackmail agency targeting bad, powerful, rich men. And when the book opens, the main character, Joe, is in the middle of a sting targeting a Hollywood producer who's this kind of known casting couch king, and it's not going particularly well. And that's a problem for Joe for a couple of reasons, one of them being that she owes her boss, the Lady Upstairs, a great deal of money, and this is the job that's finally going to even her debt.
So you've got Joe here, who's she goes into a deep chapter in this book where she describes her backstory, and I loved how that chapter was written because it took a while to get there because I kept in my mind going, how did Joe get into this business? You wrote that, and I think you've said that was the scene that got the least amount of editing in the book, right?
It absolutely was. Funny enough, that was the very first chapter I wrote. I actually wrote it for the first time as a short story, and it was the part of the book that has changed the least from its inception and has kind of always been there no matter what revision cycle I was on.
When you talk about a business like this, as you think about it, is Los Angeles the only place that this type of thing could work? Because you need to have places where people have some money in order to be blackmailed in the first place, and then second place, just the types of people that, you know, that Hollywood attracts are the people that would get themselves into these situations, right?
Absolutely, and I do think Los Angeles is particularly well-suited to this type of blackmail venture for the reasons that you mentioned, and that there's these kind of different types of society in close contact with each other. You've got the kind of Hollywood, you've got the rich elite, you've got a bunch of different kind of stratosphere of class all rubbing up against each other in these ways, and that Hollywood kind of Los Angeles and Hollywood kind of provides this ability to create a narrative about yourself in a way that I think other cities don't do the same. You can kind of come to LA and be whoever you want to be.
And just to be clear, this is an illegal business. I mean, it's illegal to extort people and such like this. So how does the lady, who's, you know, she's referred to as the lady in the book, how does she keep this business afloat?
The lady keeps the business afloat through a careful mechanism of weaponizing shame from the blackmail victims, because you're absolutely right, it is illegal to do this. Not recommended, definitely not recommended as a business, and also by bribing the police. And it is that bribe money that Joe uses to kind of help facilitate the job that's going poorly and which gets her in trouble not only with her boss but also with the cops, who are missing their hush money quite dearly.
There was a line you wrote in the book, and it was an observation by Joe, and it really, I thought, captured Los Angeles. It says, "That was the magic of Los Angeles. Over time, the artificial became as historic as the true." Can you explain what that means?
Sure, absolutely. I think Los Angeles is a city that remakes itself about every 10 years, and it has this kind of mythology about itself, and mythology about itself that's put on by other people as well. So that there's this kind of mirage quality to the city, that it's both a very real city and it's also both kind of a projection of a city.
I think people get the, especially where I live in the Midwest, we get this image of California. We think it's all the same. And I know you grew up in Northern California, but there's a distinct mm-hmm. cultural difference between Northern California and Los Angeles, Southern California, right?
Absolutely. There's a huge cultural difference, and the two areas could not be more different. Where I grew up is a little town called Arcata in rural Northern California, where it's, you know, 60 degrees year-round and rains, and kind of our main business is agriculture. And L.A. is basically a desert and never sleeps and fluctuates between, you know, 90 and 70 degrees kind of year-round. So it is, they're very different halves to the state, for sure, as well as attitudes.
When I visited Los Angeles last time, I took a tour, that Dearly Departed tour, and so you see all the macabre places around Los Angeles, and so I would think, as a fiction writer who's setting a book there, you've probably looked around that city a lot and found the different places that are not necessarily mainstream, but where a lot of fun stuff has happened.
Absolutely, and that's so funny. I have taken many a Dearly Departed tour, and I think that that kind of ties into the idea of Los Angeles as kind of this mirage, where it also has this kind of almost, you know, like you said, macabre kind of industry about some of the terrible things that have happened here. The Black Dahlia, the Night Stalker, you know, there's this kind of entrenched history of crime. And actually, my second book is going to be a feminist noir about a woman who runs a murder bus tour in Los Angeles.
Well, you've said that term a couple of times, feminist noir, and I've never thought about it in and of itself as a particular genre. Do you see it as a distinct genre in fiction?
You know, I think that it definitely is. I think that women have kind of been reclaiming the crime and noir space for some time now. You know, there's very famous examples of this, like Gone Girl, but the queen of, I would say, feminist noir is Megan Abbott. She just writes these really deliciously chewy, thought-provoking books that have this noir underpinning no matter the subject.
It seems like you can't get away from Los Angeles without talking about Raymond Chandler as far as the noir type, but what sets noir apart from other books that are set in Los Angeles, like the Michael Connelly books?
You know, I think noir has this certain feel and rhythm to it, and from the early days, it's always kind of been about top-down inequities and kind of the way that the little man can never get a fair shake against, you know, the systems. And I think that that's something that still really resonates today. And I think that that's one of the things that sets the noir genre apart, this kind of nihilistic feel to an experience of the world.
My absolute favorite scene in the book, it was a chapter, it was a longer chapter, and it took place in the Hollywood Forever Cemetery. The locals call it HOFO. Oh. And you wrote this scene, and I don't want to give anything away from it, but that Hollywood Forever Cemetery right there by Paramount Studios seems to just encapsulate so much of what Hollywood is about, bringing in the history and the current, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I actually have a funny anecdote about the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, which is that, so as you noted, it basically is right next to the Paramount Studios, like right next door to it. And that is because when Paramount Studios was first founded in the 1910s, 1920s, I believe, they actually leased the land from the cemetery, who basically was like, this movie business is really never going to make it, so sure, have the land, we'll have it back in 10 years, and they are still locked together today.
And you touch on that in the book, but you know, you've got this studio right there. So many of the studios have moved out of Hollywood. What keeps Paramount there?
You know, I think it's probably just tradition. There is something so beautiful about those kind of Paramount gates, and that they have kind of found a way to make a second livelihood for themselves as a tourist attraction, as well as actually still being a working studio.
I'm chatting with Hallie Sutton about her debut novel, The Lady Upstairs. The book is available wherever your fine books are sold. I thought your dedication was interesting. You dedicated the book to your parents, and you added the phrase, who didn't even flinch when their baby girl handed them this book. Sounds like there's a story there.
There is a little bit of a story there. You know, the book has a lot of adult content, shall we say, based on just, you know, kind of the work that these women are doing, the world that they're kind of involved in. And I am very close to my parents, and so it was a little bit shocking to hand them my book and say, this is it. This is what I've been spending all my hard work doing. And they just read it and loved it and have been very supportive the whole way through. So it's something I wanted to acknowledge and was very grateful for.
You took creative writing. You at UC Santa Cruz, Sammy the Slug, I always remember, is the mascot there. But what's the writing community like at UC Santa Cruz?
The writing community was so supportive, and I still am in touch with some of my teachers today. You know, it was such a great environment to kind of learn the craft about, because you're surrounded by all these beautiful natural phenomena. You've got the redwoods, you've got the beach. It was just a very kind of rich environment, and everyone was very supportive and generous.
Is it a true workshop?
It absolutely is. Which so you're turning in work and having people critique them, which to me always feels a little akin to basically standing naked in front of a bunch of people and asking, what do you not like here? And so it can be a very intimidating experience, but if you find really generous, kind people, it can also be really, really helpful and formative for your work.
And it seems like the workshop experience for authors is so much a part of making them the authors that they become, but do you workshop parts of a novel as you've moved on now to a professional writer?
I absolutely do. I have a couple of writing partners, including Lane Fargo, who is the writer of feminist thrillers, temper and they never learn. And I send her my work kind of at every stage, and she always provides invaluable feedback, and even when my work is, you know, not its best.
Are you amazed as you get into this now at the professional level that the things that maybe you question as you write and say, well, I don't know if this makes sense, but we'll throw it out there, that some of your colleagues notice the same things in the book that you think are maybe lacking or need better explanation?
Absolutely. There have been moments where I have kind of known parts of my plot were weak, like that doesn't totally make sense, or that's not exactly how it would happen in real life, and I have this ability to kind of go, well, maybe you're fooling somebody. Maybe you can get by on it. And it is kind of shocking how often a good critique partner will call you out on that and say, you know, that one thing, and it is just this internal feeling of like, yeah, I knew that all along. So thank you for making sure I really knew it, which is very helpful.
This first book, how long did it take you start to finish to write? I'm talking years, right?
It took, 3.5 years, and I would say about 3 major revisions of the novel.
And as those revisions happen, are you, you have to set aside your ego completely and let people who've been through this before kind of guide you, because, you know, this is your first offering.
Absolutely. You know, I think that one of the most important traits a writer can have as they move into kind of a professional sphere is an ability to set aside your own love for what you have created in service of the better narrative. So you have to say, you know, maybe I really loved that passage I wrote or that chapter I wrote, but that doesn't make it the best book possible. And so being able to kind of find a balance between those two, holding on to the things that you think really matter about the book while also finding ways to really have a vision for what the best version of that book is and be kind of ruthless in getting it there, I think that's a major key to success with writing a novel.
When a character like Joe, and there's also other characters in here, she has a good friend named Lou, and then Joe, kind of her sometimes boyfriend Jackal, I went back and forth in this book with, you know, liking them and then saying, well, I like this character better. And as the writer, as you're creating that, is that your goal to try to make these characters so multidimensional that you can't love them or hate them because they have both good and bad qualities?
Absolutely. I wanted them to be very reflective of real people because they felt very real to me as I was writing them. And I think that that's my experience with real people is that, you know, even the people that you love most dearly are capable of things that you don't love and capable of things that might actually be shocking, but that doesn't make them any less dear to you. So I wanted to create full characters that had a full life, which also meant being unlikable and being amoral at times and doing bad things as necessary.
So many writers over the years have told me that they're amazed sometimes at the things their characters are capable of. And I know it sounds silly, but it does make sense to me now that I've talked to so many writers that when you're the creator and you're nonetheless surprised by something somebody did. Did you have that experience with any of these characters?
You know, I absolutely did. There is a big moment at the middle when Joe and Lou do something pretty terrible and pretty irrevocable, and it was something that kind of came to me at a spur of the moment as I was writing the scene, and it just felt very right, but it was very dark, and it moved the book in a very dark direction, and it was kind of a shock to look at this and say, this feels like the most right thing for my character, even though it is a pretty, pretty dark move.
As you move through this process of not just writing this book, but now promoting it, what's been the biggest change in your life that you've seen? You're getting noticed by people, you know, the social media. What's the aspect of it that's something you probably didn't expect?
You know, there's almost this feel when your book comes out and when you kind of enter into this community of other crime writers, of people that I admire and I've read their work for years and I think they're fabulous, and suddenly you find yourself on kind of more equal footing with them because you're kind of accepted into the space. That's been really incredible to feel like you have these relationships with these other writers that I have idolized for so long. That has constantly blows my mind and makes me thankful every day for what I do.
Well, I just absolutely love this book. It's The Lady Upstairs by Hallie Sutton. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. It's just a unique type of story, and it's set in my favorite place to have books set, Los Angeles, California. Hallie, great offering here, and thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate speaking with you today.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Move west down Ventura Boulevard and all the bands.